twice less. So welcome. Anybody have any latent questions? I'm going to talk about a few important things today. So next week, assistive technology fair on Tuesday. That will be a great event for you. You won't be sitting down. You'll be standing up out there and meeting about eight vendors. I'll give you some pointers on how to act. And for students that are working on team projects, your midterm presentations are next Thursday. And I'll get into a little bit of that. And then after that, we'll have a VA tour and all sorts of other interesting lectures, web links you've seen before. Team project presentations. There's a sign-up sheet for presentations. So during the break, have your teams come up and sign up for a slot. People that, even with 5 minutes, I think we're going to go over time a little bit. So if your team has a member that can't stay a little bit later, then you should sign up for an early slot, okay? And you get 5 minutes per team, so it's really important to be concise and to the point. And it's really important that you practice your presentation. Nothing improves your presentation better than practice. And with practice, your presentation will be a factor of three better. So it's worth your time to practice your presentation. Time it. Have other people listen to it to give you feedback before you come here. We will have evaluation sheets, so everybody will evaluate the other presenters, and I use that in the grading. So you'll be essentially evaluating with everybody else's presentations. So there's two ways of doing this, and the way that is most time efficient is that if you guys can send me your presentations like the day before, and I can put them all on my laptop, and that way that we don't have to shuffle laptops and restart computers and fool around with things. So if you can do that, that'll save time. If you don't want to do that, then part of your 5 minutes is going to come out of swapping laptops and stuff like that. So so please send me your PowerPoints. And if you have any videos, include that as a separate file, and I'll make sure that it all works together so you don't have to bring your laptop or a thumb drive or anything, okay? But if you want to bring your Mac or whatever, you can, but figure on how much time it's going to take you to set it up and pull it out for the next person, okay? Major items for your presentation should be introducing you and your team and talking about the problem statement. So you should assume that you're talking to people who don't know what the heck you're doing. So you should make it as clear as possible. Not saying I'm working on the playground project, you need to be more specific than that. I'm really interested in what you've done. That is, what process did you go through? Who did you talk to? What did you learn? And how did that affect you're thinking about your design concepts. If you have any sketches, scan them in and put them on a slide. Let's certainly like to see, you know, what you've done. You don't have to include every sketch, you know, just a couple major ones. And not only sketches of what you think is going to work, but maybe some early sketches as well, so we can know the evolution of your thinking. Okay? If you've made any prototypes, even if they're real crude, take a picture of them, put them in a slide. That way you can talk about them. Anything that's in a picture, you don't have to describe as much because a picture is worth 1,000 words, right? And a short video could be helpful as well. Okay? You should be talking about what design concept or concepts you're going to be pursuing and what you're going to be doing the remainder of the quarter. So those are the things I want to hear. So I talked about practice. Now, the other thing I want to say is that your presentation should be a presentation as if you were a professor, not a student. So I want you to think of yourselves in those terms, that you're at the job that really good job and you're asked to do a presentation, this is how I want you to run your presentation as if you were a professional. I want to see a lot of confidence, energy, passion, a lot of volume. I mean, you guys have probably seen all these other presentations of people, you know, just plodding along and low energy, low volume. I want to see something high energy, high volume. It's really important that you practice these skills, because this is one thing I guarantee that you're going to be doing throughout your lifetime, presenting. So it's good to get practice now. Okay. We have more sign-up sheets today than ever before. So here's the Meet with Dave sign-up sheet. I'm available, you know, pretty much all during the week. There's the driver sign-up sheet. So anybody who has a car on campus and wants to chauffeur one or more students to the VA, please sign up here. We need to have more drivers. If you plan to drive on your own, let me know as well. I want to make sure that everybody's taken care of and accounted for. Now, I should mention that these tours are the highlight of the course. A lot of people really enjoy these tours, so it shouldn't be something that you dismiss, because this is, you're going to be in a different environment and see a lot of different things, and try out different things too. Try out a power wheelchair, a manual wheelchair, a arm-powered bicycle, and work with some other devices. So it'll be really interesting for you. And then a week after that, we'll go to the motion and gait analysis lab, which is in Menlo Park. And there you'll get an idea of how they can quantify the walking of kids with disabilities, cerebral palsy. So that is really interesting. If you're into robotics and stuff, this is the basis of movement that is used for these exoskeletons, as well as some of the games and movies that involve realistic movement. If you're working on a project, I encourage you to get to talk to your friends and classmates about your project, because they can give you other ideas and a different perspective. And also, Margaret is available as well. She's can give her perspective and a lot of great ideas. So involve other people outside your project and other people in the class. Okay. Now, after your presentation, the Tuesday afterwards is when your midterm project report is due. So I think I had it written up in the syllabus that should be a minimum 5 pages, which should be no problem at all if you include, you know, some pictures in there. It's important for you to use person-first terminology. I talked about that. If you don't know what that is, I can give you some links. It's really important for to have it be a really good document. So get somebody else to proofread it. That helps a lot. And don't print it out. Just put it in Word or PDF format and email it to me. Okay? You can have color stuff in there. That's fine. But you don't have to print it out. And the midterm presentation and report are practice for the final, your final presentation and report. So I'll be marking up your reports and giving them back to you, and the evaluations for your presentation everybody will do, and I'll disseminate those as well, so you know what everybody else has said about your presentation. So you need to take that into account when you do your final presentation and final report. Okay? Yes? Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, it's the same thing, but in printed form. Now, I want you to make it as you know, scientific and professional as possible. Okay. So, assistive technology fair next Tuesday. Here are the vendors. There's going to be a wheelchair, a service dog, computer tools. We're going to have a car here. We're going to have a Beam remote presence device with Henry Evans kicking around a soccer ball from Los Altos Hills. We're going to have a Braille labeler, and Robert Lieber, who's the president of the company, will be talking later on in the quarter about what a people are there. How is your device or service different, better than everybody else's? And what design development process did they use coming up with their product? And how many prototypes did they make? And how do you advertise stuff? So I want you to go around to each vendor and ask, you know, some questions, interact with them. It'll be really good for you to do that. So today we're going to have Gary Burke talk about issues of human interface design as it relates to prosthetics. So we're going to take a little break here so we can get swapped. So come on down and sign the attendance sheet, sign up to meet with me, sign up for a time slot, sign up for driving, get a cookie, you know the drill. Yeah. Good. Okay. So the thing to do is we'll probably give your presentation, you know, to me. Sometime we'll arrange to do that afterwards. Okay. And were you here on Tuesday? Okay. All right. Yeah. So let me know when you're the week afterwards, you know, when you have, you know, like about 15 minutes to do your presentation. That sound good? Yeah, thanks.
Years. And I think the prostheses really are the ultimate in human interface. We're not really talking about, you know, sitting at a computer and having ergonomic space. We're talking about real life interface stuff here. So we're going to cover that a little bit with this background of prosthetics. I think if I were to have a subtitle where this would work, there we go, I would talk about why prosthetics is different than robotics. There's been this last probably 5 years or so, I've noticed it more, this interchangeability between these terms, prosthetics and robotics. And the prosthetic community goes, oh my God, we're not doing robotics, they're different. And the robotics community says, well, we don't understand why they're different, they're just trying to do the same thing. So I kind of want to talk about that difference a little bit today. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about how we make prostheses, although at the end I brought a couple that you guys could play with, and feel free to come down. Feel free to ask questions in the process, too, because we'll just kind of wing it as we go. Like I said, I rarely practice this stuff, so we'll see what happens. We're all very familiar with this. The great the great scholars of trivia, otherwise known as the media, tend to embellish a bit on these wonderful images. And despite Oscar Pistorius' social situation, he is rather quick. And there was this perception that if we just throw some blades on the bottom of his legs, that he will be faster than human. And that, of course, begs the next subtitle. If we are faster with prostheses, why don't we all just cut off our legs? And so hopefully by the end of today, we will have saved maybe 100 or so amputations in the future and think about things a little bit differently. We've got to change our perception of what prosthetics is to some degree, and especially as it relates to this better than human function, because quite frankly, they're still attached to humans. So we're going to go through some of that. We're going to go through some human decision-making processes, things that are important to people, and see if we can't at the end come up with some generalizable things that will help you in your future with human interface design. So this is Oscar. It's an interesting thing. I mean, if you think about running mechanics, you realize that, you know, in order to run, you have to place 2 to 4 times your body weight through your legs. Well, now we've got a much smaller area on which we can now place all of that force. This is over the residual limb, whatever's left. And if we disregard the blade at the bottom and we focus today on that human interface portion, that socket, then we realize that it comes with some interesting complications. First of all, it is a prosthesis must fit intimately enough to comfortably support the limb during high loading, to not bother soft tissue, not bother the bone, and transfer the motion extremely efficiently, try that again, between the human and the device. I don't know of many other devices that really have to do that. And so, if you think about it, in his case, he's got a relatively long residual limb, a relatively long leg of which to transfer some of those pressures, but not everybody does. And so you've got 4 times or so body weight running through the center of this, but now the foot is offset a little bit, so your ground reaction force is in a different place. So in addition to all of this vertical loading through this prosthesis, you also have torques about the limb. There's no way that we can, at this point, apply something that doesn't have some motion between the limb and the socket, such that they are so efficient, otherwise you'd never be able to take it off and on. So these torques are really important for the overall comfort of the prosthesis. And so, where does the pressure go? If we were to exceed human performance and be able to lift a car with our new fancy prosthetic arm, where does the pressure go? Well, in a robot, obviously it's attached to the ground at some point, and so it transfers that all through that. But now you've got a person, and sometimes you've got maybe a 2-inch limb under which you've taken all of that rotatory or torque. Now, you guys are mostly engineers. You understand torque a lot better than I do, but it seems like a lot. And sometimes people don't want to lift cars, and sometimes people just want to walk, and they want to get from point A to point B because they've got other things wrong. Maybe they're diabetic. Maybe they've got a different level. Maybe they've got a really high amputation, and maybe they got some bad skin in there. And maybe they're going to grow, which makes me mad. So while robotics starts with a task, right? We're going to put the windshield on the car. We're going to build a robot to do that. It's going to be really cool. We start the other way. We start with the human. We start with what's left and what the goals and what the activities are. And then we build from that end. So it's almost the reverse process of some of the robotic stuff that we see. But the problem is that people change too. And so how do, on this little kid, ensure, and I'm going to get on my soapbox here because this is kind of important to me, how do we ensure the long-term success? Right? It's easy to print a socket. Get your 3D printer out, you throw it down, you print yourself a socket, you run it off to Vietnam and fit it on someone, and you pat yourself on the back that you're helping the world. But what happens when that kid grows? They still need a prosthesis. And who is going to fix that prosthesis when it breaks? And who's going to deal with the skin problems as they grow and it's no longer fitting? When I went to Vietnam, they were so proud of the big closet full of prostheses that they'd gotten from the United States that they couldn't use and couldn't fix. So we need to think about that people's lives are involved, and there is a long-term aspect to this that needs to be thought of before we run off and start making things. So given that everybody is different and we have some long-term needs, are there some generalizable things that we can say about this process and what's important to people? Because that's really what we're talking about here. That's my daughter, by the way. And a few years back, I had gone to a conference on how to take care of people in healthcare. You know, not just the health part. We can do that. But it's the people part of that. And what they talked about was these moments of truth. And the example that I've used, they talk about restaurants, but I like one that's a little more applicable. And a moment of truth are independent but significant and often overlapping considerations for any device, right? So let's say that you saved up your money because you want to buy a watch. And the watch is $1,000, and you know this is the watch that you want to buy, and so you finally save your money and you go to the store and you find that watch and it's perfect. And you put it on and it's comfortable and it's lightweight and it's just exactly what you'd hoped it'd be. And you take it home and you realize that every day it's another 12 minutes off. That's a moment of truth. Because you have a decision to make at that point. Do you take the watch back and say this is crap? Or do you keep it and say, wow, it's really nice looking and it's everything I wanted. I don't care that it works. And so the importance of each of those moments of truth involved in that watch are really what are going to dictate the success of your guy's device on any particular person. And everybody's going to be a little bit different. Some people will say, I'm taking this thing back. It doesn't tell the time. I need to know what time it is. And others are going to say, nah, it's fine. Looks cool. Feels great. I love it. And so those moments of truth, I think, are critical to any human interface design. And so I'm going to spend sort of the remainder talking about what I think are the moments of truth in human interface. And they're what I call the 5 C's. Comfort. Cosmesis. Thank God there's a C in function. Cost. And cool. And I think these 5 things all interface together in order to make that so-called device, that perfect device that somebody would use and wear and try. And so we're going to talk about each of them for a moment. What makes something comfortable? You know, you get a pair of shoes and somebody says they're the greatest shoes they've ever had, and you put them on and you think these things are horrible. So I think we can talk almost easier about what makes something uncomfortable rather than what makes something comfortable. And so I think that for something to be comfortable, something that you wear, It has to transfer pressure from the device to you, or to you to the device. It has to be no noxious stimuli. People don't like things that vibrate, typically. You know, the phone is there, it vibrates, it makes you a little nutty sometimes. You're always checking. You get phantom vibrations now because it happens so often. It's a crazy thing. People also don't really like noises. They don't always want to know everybody to know they're walking down the hallway because this motor in their prosthesis is creating this whirring noise. Heat is a big one. Heat is a big one. Heat's tough for people, some people to handle. And if things are too hot, too encapsulating, they're not going to tolerate them. Is it a hassle? Is it too hard to put on every morning? Or if you wake up in the middle of the night and you have to go to the bathroom, how do you get there? Because it takes 20 minutes to put a prosthesis on, or you have to put your shoes on and they have this really interesting way of lacing. So there can't be too much nuisance-y stuff. People are not very tolerant of that. And it can't be too heavy. And so what we'll talk about, and sensitivity. I threw that one in this week, right? You've got people have material sensitivities. They've got sensitivities to all kinds of different things. And so they don't tolerate things that obviously that cause rashes and irritation. So if we go back to our watch example, I wouldn't say this is necessarily a comfortable watch to wear. Nor is this one, right? The Fitbits are basically causing skin irritation in a whole bunch of people, and they're ticked off, right? So comfort's out the window. And comfort, I think, in the prosthetic world is really one of the most important things that there is. This is an interesting case. It's one of my cases, a young lady who had a tumor of her arm, and they amputated her arm at the shoulder. And we built this prosthesis, and it looks pretty good, and it fit, I think, quite well. Wasn't really too hot. And she sent me a note about 2 weeks after this, and she says, "I love my new arm. Thank you so much. It's great. I don't wear it out of the house because it's so heavy. I get so tired, I can't wear it for very long. So I wear it around the house, and it's great." Well, that's not what I designed this prosthesis for. Right, so for me, this is a failure, right? A failure of comfort. And I know her insurer wasn't particularly happy that all she did was wear it around the house as well. So that comfort issue is really an important one, I think, when it comes to things that people have to wear. Cosmesis, C number two. Or the second C is probably better. Cosmesis is how something looks, right? Does it look cool? Maybe. Cosmetics is really an interesting problem for us. People's perception of cosmetic has a huge scale of what everybody else determines is appropriate and cosmetic and good looking. And so cosmesis affects us a little bit. People will turn things away quite readily if they don't look how they think they should. And some of that in the amputation side of the world has to do with injury and self-perception and changes to body and body image. These are very important things, but that also affects why somebody would buy a watch or a jacket or a pair of shoes. And so cosmesis is a really interesting problem for us. Some people insist that prostheses look just like real people, real hands. That sort of projects. He's missing his last two fingers, 4 and 5. And so we built a prosthesis that looks, I think, pretty good. Right? But some people really don't care that it looks like a human. They want it to actually look like a prosthesis or something else. It's almost a badge. Or they just don't care at all, and they're much more interested in some of the other C's, so they just let that cosmetic side go. And that's okay. The balance between comfort and cosmesis is best demonstrated by this particular thing, and I suppose we could put cute in there as another C, because half of this audience is saying, "Wow, those are cute," and the other half of the audience is saying, "Why would anybody wear those things if they hurt?" Right? So that balance between comfort and cosmesis is best described right there. And we battle this all day long in my practice. function. I'm a function freak. I think that everything that we should do should function well. Not everybody agrees, especially the people that have to wear some of these things. We'll give up function in some cases. We'll talk about that. But I define function as basically it does what we say it's going to do and does so reliably. The greatest engineering feat I know of is the split hook design for the below-the-elbow amputee. This is the most functional device we have. It is lightweight. It's durable. It's inexpensive. It's easy to replace. It's easy to repair. You get feedback through the cable mechanism, so you know exactly how much pressure you're putting on any particular device, and you know without looking whether it's open or closed. Right? That's pretty good. There's not a lot of devices that you can say meet all of those criteria. But cosmetically, we got a problem. Right? I mean, it's got a stigma. It's got a cosmetic problem, and people will turn away their improved function. Everything okay? Their improved function for the cosmetic side of this. And that's a problem for me, because I'm a function guy. I like this sort of thing. And this is especially true for people who have lost both arms, right? Because now function becomes the critical part. They've got to be able to eat. They've got to be able to make their own food. They've got to be able to use the restroom. And so these issues are just multiplied in someone who has lost both their hands, especially in a traumatic situation. Some of the kids that are born with stuff like this find ways to do everything. It's really rather impressive. But acquired amputations, especially of both arms, are tough. And where regardless of where people go in their process of healing, most end up back in hooks because they really are the functional device. We hear the term bionic just continuously these days. I swear if another company calls themselves bionic, I'm going to scream. I don't even know what bionic means, right? And when I was growing up, it was the bionic man, and that was kind of cool, and that was kind of interesting. They made that term up at that point. Now it's become part of this vernacular. So I Googled bionic, and of course I got Christina Aguilera, which did nothing for me. Instead, I kind of searched a little more now that I figured out how to use Google. And there's a new trend in upper extremity prosthetics, right? These multi-finger hands. If you Google bionic, everything does this, and it's really interesting. And I have a problem, because now we've not only increased the complexity, the weight, decreased the reliability, we've lost all the feedback mechanism as well. And so the function is similar to this. Right? We haven't gained anything by having multiple fingers in terms of function that I've seen yet. Now, will it lead to something? Maybe. We'll see. But it's an interesting problem, and we'll talk about it when we get to cool, because it's kind of cool that all the fingers move. But when you talk about function, these two people are doing exactly the same thing. My nephew wears glasses without lenses, and again, we're coming back to this function versus cosmesis thing. And some people will absolutely give up their hooks for something that is more cosmetic, and they will give up function completely. And some people will be so worried about how their prosthesis looks that they will get a passive device that does nothing but looks nice, rather than wear a hook that actually helps them do their daily activities. So cool. We got a problem with cool. There's lots of cool things out there. I was at a lecture last couple weeks ago, and the chairman of orthopedics at the Mayo Clinic was talking about our problem with cool and new technologies. You know, when we start to apply you know, if it's a cool watch or an iPad or something like that, cool is fine, right? But if cool happens to be a hip joint that you're placing in somebody's body, and oh, by the way, in 6 months it's going to cause tumors and metal fragments and big problems, it's not so cool. And I think that we don't take our time very often with cool, that we jump on the latest technologies and the latest things because it's cool without really getting any good quantifiable benefit. I think when iPad, and maybe correct, you guys may know better than I, but as I understand it, when iPad came out, they didn't know what it would do. There was no defined function. They just said, here, we know you can scroll. It's kind of cool. And people bought like crazy. And then the function followed. I'm not sure that's fair in the prosthetic world. I'm not sure we can do that. So there's a whole series of things that you find on the internet these days that are really cool. Multiple finger function, there's partial finger types of activities. This particular hand is all over it. And always there was a really interesting thing on one of the morning shows, I don't know which one, where they brought a chef and he got this new bionic hand and he was going to cook. And if you watch carefully, you'll realize this cool bionic hand kind of hung out over here while he did all his cooking over here. And he said, you know, I can use this to get a hot thing off the stove. And I thought, that's a $100,000 prosthesis. And there we get to this sort of balance between the cost and the cool, and we'll talk about that more in just a minute. There are cool things that are out there. There are cool things that are coming. Upper extremity, this is the Vanderbilt knee, and I had the opportunity to meet with Michael Goldfarb, who's the developer of this, and it's pretty cool. This is a powered device that it can actually get you up step over step. That seems like a good idea, especially if you spend all day on the stairs. But I only go upstairs once in a while. So where's that justification for that particular cool? And there's some noise associated with that, and some people are going to love that, and some aren't. I don't know. We're going to find out. I like this car. It's a Bentley. I think I need it. And I think it's $225,000. I don't know. Anybody know anything about Bentleys? $225,000? Last year? There we go. So, we have a little problem in our country, and it's pretty much in every country, is how do we balance cool and necessary and functional with cost? Because on one hand, we've got all of us going, I want the latest, greatest thing. I deserve it. I've had an amputation. I need the coolest thing out there. And the insurance company, who is doing everything in their power to save a dime, is going to say, no. What do we do with that? So I'm going to flip here and show you Jesse. This falls totally into the cool end. So this is out of Northwestern. Some friends of mine have done some work in what they call targeted muscle reinnervation, where they've taken the nerve out of the brachial plexus and then planted it into his chest wall. Now, Jesse lost both arms in an electrical accident. And so they are able to then separate out the nerves and use them to control the various aspects of this device. It's pretty cool. They're starting to figure out how to maybe even get a little feedback. In other words, can he tell when the hand is open or closed? Is it opening or closing? But for this level of amputation, this is about as good a function as we've ever seen. And it's cool. And it costs $300,000 at the least. Right, so when you've got to pay your teachers, and you've got to pay your policemen and your firemen, or you could fix one Jesse. How do we do that? How do we reconcile that in our heads? Of course, no lecture is complete without a sixth C. And this C is actually not really fitting in with all of the others, because I can't think of a lot of examples where it fits in to regular society as much. But it is absolutely critical aspect of the prosthetic world that we always forget about. And that is change. Not just psychological change. I mean, if you think about people, humans in general, and psychological change, we're kind of finicky, right? There's a restaurant around the corner. It's great this week. Next week, not so much. Too crowded, too hot, too busy, too expensive. So we're a little finicky with our things, and so what may be cool for us one day, what may work cosmetically one day, isn't necessarily what's going to work the next, but change is a much bigger problem than that, because we also go through a lot of physical change. And when you get to be old like me, you'll realize how drastic that really is. We do go through yearly change, right? Sometimes, well, I'm growing longitudinally, but some of us grow wider. And so that relates is an interesting problem. And when you wear a prosthesis over 10 years or 20 years or whatever it is, your skin, your bone, your muscle, all reacts to that pressure of walking or carrying a prosthesis. It changes. I mean, this perfect example is a wedding ring, right? I've been married 20 years. If I go out one night and decide I'm going to cruise town and I take my wedding ring off, I'm not fooling anybody, right? The skin has changed. The tissue underneath has all changed from wearing that ring for 20 years, right? So think about wearing a prosthesis where you're putting all your weight through this thing. And the amount of change that occurs to that skin and bone. When I was in Vietnam, there was a guy who had his prosthesis for 30 years, same one. And there was a bolt that went right into the side of his knee. And the skin, bone, everything grew around this bolt. And so we took his prosthesis off, and there's a hole that was filled with skin right around, and it was the shape of the bolt. His anatomy altered to the pressure of the prosthesis, and it happens all the time. That's a little drastic, but it happens all the time. So a typical prosthesis is really only going to last a couple of years before the anatomy changes in response to those pressures. So even if you have the perfect prosthesis one year, it may not be the perfect prosthesis the next. There are monthly changes. Ladies, unfortunately, I'm going to pick on you, right? Cyclical changes are a problem. You get volume and fluid retention. Pregnancy is an issue. You get changes in the size. And if you're trying to have a prosthesis that's rigid, that supports your weight and doesn't change, and you've got this system, this human that's changing continuously, how can that interface match? How do those work? There are daily changes. You go out for margaritas, you have a little bit of extra salt on that rib. Tastes pretty good. Right? The next morning, your rings and watches don't fit so good, do they? For those of you who know, of course. And so those daily volume changes are a really interesting problem. We have people, the largest cause of amputation is diabetes. And along with diabetes, we get kidney disease, right? So you have fluctuations in volume that can be rather drastic at times. How do you design a device to fit intimately and poorly all at the same time? And then there's that special thing of hourly changes. This one kills us. There's some great work coming out of the University of Washington that says you put your prosthesis on at 10 o'clock in the morning and you wear it for an hour, and your limb will reduce in volume by 3%. And so at that point, you have to alter it, and what we use is socks. So you add a sock and you put your prosthesis back on, and now it fits again, right? And then, in addition to the next hour, your limb continuing to shrink, the sock changes. Oh, good. So now we've got the sock shrinking, we've got the limb shrinking, we've got the prosthesis that's exactly the same. And so we've, for years, been working on ways to vary that socket during the day. And hopefully in the near future we'll have some ideas on how to do that. But as far as I know, we have yet to come up with a design that changes in the same way that we do. And when you start to deal with children and they grow, we can't always predict how they're going to change. Sometimes they get a little chunkier. Sometimes they get a little taller. Sometimes both. And so managing that intimacy, that intimate fit in that environment, I think is really the crux of what makes prosthetics different than anything else that's out there. The perfect device is one that balances all of those things for any particular individual, all five C's plus change. I don't know that there's such a thing. So a couple of take-homes, then we can ask some questions. There's plenty of time, and we'll do a little show and tell as well. We need to start to critically evaluate what's going on out there. The internet's a wonderful tool, but there's a lot of junk too. And the media doesn't help us much. So when you see the miracle, stop and think, really look at it, critically evaluate what it is that you're looking at. As designers, we need to narrow our goals a little bit, right? We can't fit one thing for everybody. It just isn't going to happen. Pick your target audience. Pick that group that you really want to focus on and work within those parameters with that group. Hopefully, we've learned that a prosthesis is not just something that you slap on, that it's not a series of parts that makes you better than human, and that you can ultimately do very well with a prosthesis, but there's still a human attached. It's not a series of parts. And my old chairman was great. He used to say, just because you have a hammer doesn't mean everything's a nail. Just because you have a 3D printer doesn't mean everything needs to be 3D printed. Sorry to pick on you. With that, I thank you for your time. We got time for questions and further discussion. So, thanks. Designing a new pair of shoes or next time you go to a restaurant, that the concepts are very similar about how people think and how people work and what's important. Yeah. I'm sorry? Of the nerves that we're starting to find, you can tap on and you can feel a thumb, or you can sort of find different parts of the hand and define different parts of the arm, so that we can, and for those of you who didn't hear, she's talking about the Jesse video, so that we can hopefully at some point use those points to bring some proprioception back. But at this point, he has no idea other than his muscle reaction whether that hands or fingers are opening or closing. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of cultural, another C. There's a lot of cultural things that go on with that as well. When I was in Vietnam, there was not a single person who ever complained that their prosthesis didn't feel good, right? But when they went to go home, they put their old prosthesis on, put their new one on their back, and go away. So, yeah, it happens in those environments, but I think it does happen to some degree. But I think people who have worn prosthesis for many years also realize that their first impression isn't always accurate either, that there's sensations that go on, the nerves have been rerouted. We're kind of going, yeah, I think that's okay, I'm not sure, and the next day it's fine, or the next day it's worse. And you can't always tell. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of that back and forth, and it's important that, as a prosthetist, that my patients are able to get in when they need to. Because then otherwise the soft tissues start to fall apart. You get big ulcers, you get wounds, they're out of their prosthesis, they're swollen, and you end this cycle of, you know, change that's very difficult to manage. So, yes, I think people will do that at times. And then if you add in that the diabetic problem, which is that the sensation in the limb is often diminished because of the lack of circulation. And so you can't always feel trauma. And that's really what happens with diabetic foot in the beginning, right? You lose those sensations. The skin gets dry and cracked. You have neuropathy. And then you start to get wounds and you don't even know. And that leads to further amputation. So it is an interesting cycle. That it's tight. It has to do with the distribution of force, the friction within the device, and how well it's held to the limb, right? What we call suspension. How well is it holding to that person? And if there's movement, there's that tight feeling that you're talking about, then you're going to get blisters. And just like any runner, you know, amputee runners get blisters and skin irritation and all of that stuff. And so you design around that limb. You know, Oscar Pistorius has some interesting things. He was born without his legs, which actually, if he has an unfair advantage, that's it. Because he's able to walk on the end of his legs, whereas many amputees cannot. And so because of that, we can use that in the prosthesis to decrease some of this vertical motion. It kicks more on the end than most people do. So he is probably a lot less prone to skin damage and irritation than someone who's undergone a traumatic amputation.
What's the status of prosthetics that attach to the bone directly rather than to the residual?
Yeah. So there's a push, obviously, because of this interface, this socket and human interface thing, to see if we can't get rid of it. And so it's been a while now. Out in Sweden, gentlemen have developed a bone peg, essentially, that went into the bone. It was pure titanium and then exited the skin at the end and has a peg that you put the remainder of the prosthesis attached to. Yeah, everybody's cringing over here. It's funny. And so the good side is that, yeah, there are people that have these. There's probably 5 countries now that are doing this. It only works in above-the-knee amputees and in humeri, above the elbow, and right now in thumbs because of the forces that are being now put through the bone. The problem is, and a really interesting aspect to this is, and this is secondhand through a friend of mine, when you put that peg into the bone, the skin has to move around that peg to some degree. And when you do that, you create an opening that goes not just into the skin, but all now goes all the way right into the center of the bone. And all of the x-rays of these all have these big spaces, these gaps. I'm not going to say they're infected, but there's certainly movement, and there's certainly some drainage that occurs. And so they all wear towels. Every one of them wears a towel around their leg. Now, they wouldn't give this up if they had to. Every one of them wants to keep this because they don't have to wear a socket anymore. But they're all oozing. They're all potentially infected, and the long term is pretty questionable at this point. Be nice. I'd be okay with that. Yeah, it's hard because we're using a lot of so-called medical-grade materials to stop some of the skin irritation that we get, so some of the medical-grade silicones, which have problems of their own, right? Some people are just sensitive to those interfaces. We're using a fair amount of, you know, aluminum, titanium, stainless steel. Titanium's interesting, very lightweight, but when it fractures, when it fails catastrophically. So if you have someone who's running on their titanium prosthesis and they're cruising down the road, that titanium failed, it's done. You're down on the ground, hopefully there's not a car coming. If you have a steel device, it's going to bend, and you're going to know and you're going to be able to stop, figure out how you're going to get home before you fall in front of a car. So the use of those materials and how where they fit into that prosthesis is really important. Yeah. Yeah, and then we can decide what materials are going to be best suited for that person. Carbon fiber is involved in a lot of that external socket because it's lightweight, right? We can make it laminated very thin, but then we lose some of the adjustability for those folks that are constantly changing. So where's that balance? Unusual? Interesting. I really like what I do. And part of the reason is because every day is different and everything is different and we see crazy things along the way. I'm not sure I could narrow it to one. Certainly, when I was at the University of Oklahoma, we saw a large number of congenital cases, people that were born with all kinds of interesting things. I don't know why Oklahoma. I'm not even going to venture that, especially if there's Oklahomans here. But a lot of really interesting limbs and shapes and designs and challenges to try to design around things that are left. And sometimes, just on the side, we don't provide a prosthesis at all. And that's sort of that hammer-nail question. I was in court yesterday, actually, on this very issue, on a guy who lost a finger. And my advice was that you don't wear a prosthesis at all. And that's hard to hear, right? Especially if you're born a little kid with one arm missing below the elbow. Mom doesn't want to hear that they don't need a prosthesis. But we can't replace sensation. We can't really replace function. So in some cases, no prosthesis may be the right answer. Okay. With above-the-knee prosthetics. This is a relatively newer design, microprocessor-based knee, right? So what does the microprocessor do? Well, it looks at the position of, it has an algorithm, just like anything else. It knows where the knee is supposed to be at any particular time in the gait cycle. So it knows the gait cycle, and it knows that when you hit your heel, that you need this knee to be extremely stable. And therefore, it turns on a little hydraulic cylinder so that the knee becomes stable when you hit your heel. And as you roll over and get through the cycle, we now need to be able to swing the leg forward smoothly and easily, so it turns off that hydraulic cylinder, and so it swings forward smoothly. That's all it does. And if you do, this one's particularly fancy, because if you're drunk one night and you go three times back and forth, it locks. I like that. The socket design, this is really that custom part that we talk about, right? We have to transfer those forces, but we also have to transfer some of the vertical forces too. So these prostheses, I mean, think about above the knee amputation, right? It comes up through here and you've got a femur and you've got a bunch of muscle that goes around that femur, and a femur is basically round, right? And if you grab your own thigh, it's going to rotate a lot. So the biggest challenge in above-the-knee prosthetics is controlling rotation in this way, transverse rotation. Yeah. Yeah. You don't need it. I'll talk about that in a second. Good question, though, yeah. And so we have to control rotation. We have to control vertical loading, and so we've got to cover as much area as possible. So the socket design has to come up around the bone that you sit on, way up there. And so we get very close to our patients. The foot and ankle mechanism, actually, this is a this particular one is carbon fiber. And what happens in normal gait, you hit your heel, right, and you roll over, and then you push off your toe. as you hit your heel with a prosthetic foot, the carbon fiber deflects and it collapses a little bit. So it simulates that ankle plantar flexion. Once you add an ankle joint, and there are ankle joints, especially for those cases where, you know, uneven terrain and, you know, you've got to have some absorption of those things, then you can put an ankle joint in there and it'll, you know, move when you put weight on it. It'll actually plantar flex in the appropriate time. But now you've added weight and complexity. And certainly you've added more things that are going to break. Right? People don't want to have to come see me. I'm like a dentist that way. It's bad. This particular microprocessor, this prosthesis in its entirety is about $63,000. You could buy a nice car for that. Not quite a Bentley, but it gets both legs. Yeah, that's right. Right. So can you do those activities without a microprocessor knee? Absolutely. I can get the cost of this process. Well, the Jiper Knee project that we're working on, right, that went up, started here in Sanford, moved up to DREV in San Francisco, $20 for a knee. Right? Does it sense? No. Is it stable? Does it allow you to walk in a natural fashion? Absolutely. So where's that line? For me to purchase this knee, it's almost $20,000. The advantage, well, this is one of those great cases, right? We just finished a State of Defiance conference in my academy that I headed up, and it looked at what the heck these things do that's so different than any other knee, right? Because everybody's revolting. Why should we pay this? Here's the perfect question. And what we found is that the only, so far, advantage that we can find is that they tend to be a little bit safer, right? In someone who's sort of on that edge of being able to really control that knee, and someone who's strong enough to actually lift the thing, because you'll see it's heavy, if you go to fall, it will actually react and keep you from falling. And I think it's the reliability of it as much as it is the microprocessor, right? Because if you have a straight hydraulic cylinder, it doesn't always catch. But the microprocessor ensures that it does at that time. And I think that's about the only advantage that I can find. You have to charge it every night.
Well, that could be a big advantage. You have to cost there too.
Right, so you can reduce your cost of hospitalizations associated with falls, but we don't know yet.
What else do you
have? In my bag. Change in size of limb, but basically carbon fiber feet on both. This one just doesn't have the full carbon fiber foot. One of the ways that we're holding prostheses on are these cool little silicone sleeves. Medical grade, of course. And so you basically roll this on to whatever's left, and the adhesion between the skin and this helps hold it in place. And there's this pin on the bottom, and then there's a pin hole in the bottom of the prosthesis. So basically, once this is on and you've got a sock over it, you just slide in, potentially, and the prosthesis stays on. You push the button. So you push the button and it'll come out. Very reliable, creates its own new set of problems, yes. Parts of them are. The liners are kind of a bear, and over time, especially if you have any open sores, any wounds, they just absorb all that bacteria, and it's tough to get out of the silicone. The rest of it is easy. Yeah? We use healing as the guide. So typically, depending on the cause of amputation, 4 to 6 to 8 weeks after surgery, we start with the first prosthesis. The difficulty at that stage of this thing is that you're swollen. right? You've got this big puffy leg that doesn't really look like a leg at all. And so the prosthesis not only doesn't last very long, maybe 6 months tops, but you're changing almost continuously under the pressure of walking. So that's a tough time for folks. Yeah. Yeah. So, in theory, 80% typically of the cost of a prosthesis is covered by an insurance company. Things are changing rapidly.
Which way?
Dare you ask? That's another soapbox altogether. Yeah, we're apparently, according to Medicare, which is the one of our largest payers of prostheses, we're rather fraudulent. And so they've decided they're going to take a lot of our money away because of all the fraudulent prostheses that we've placed. So things are changing. We're fighting with the government. We're fighting with private insurers to demonstrate that what we do is important or not and effective or not. So the discussion that I'm having here with you today about cost versus cool, we're under the pressure from the patients to say, I need this. We call a call from a lady today who can barely get out of her wheelchair, but she has to have a C-leg, this microprocessor knee. Well, we know that's not appropriate, but where's that line? And how do we convince those payors that what we do is appropriate, effective, will reduce long-term medical costs? Because that's important, and I think we do, as compared to using a wheelchair or not having a prosthesis. All right. Well, thank you all again. I appreciate you. Come down and play.
Thanks, Gary. Okay, if you haven't signed up,